The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. SparkFile. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my SparkFile. SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile.
Welcome to the Spark File, your one-stop pick-a-mix of creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Cammie.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are good questions, and we have got answers.
A Spark File is a place where you consistently collect all your inspirations and fascinations.
Here's the deal. We are makers, and we make all sorts of things.
And if you're anything like us, and you're making stuff all the time, or want to be making stuff all the time, you know that the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry.
So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspirations that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a crucial backup plan for your creative work.
Or a spark that has been fascinating me since I was a very young child.
Ooh. Every episode, we're going to reach into the Spark File and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us too.
And if you're not careful, you just might find your true calling. So without further ado, let's open up
the Spark File.
Cams, can I be honest with you?
Yes.
It got to the part where I was like, had been deleted.
Oh.
And I was like, what?
What am I going to say?
And I remembered it's there a spark that sparked me since I was little.
Pulled that right out of your butt.
Cams, mm-hmm. I've been waiting to tell you this.
What?
Here's a fun update.
What?
Listeners will remember the dark spark I shared about the survivors of Larry Nassar.
Oof.
If you haven't listened to it, you may want to go back, give it a spin or not. It's your life. Live it as you see fit. But Broadway star, gymnastics enthusiast, and friend of the Spark File, Michael Barres, shared this bit of news with me.
What?
This is from the AP. A reporter named Will Graves wrote the following. Simone Biles wants to bring gymnastics to the masses and plans to bring some of her friends along for the ride. The Olympic and world champion is headlining a tour in the fall of 2020 that will be a mixture of sports and entertainment intended to inspire the next generation of female athletes. The Gold Over America Tour will visit more than 35 cities, including New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. The women-only roster will reunite Biles with a longtime friend, Caitlin Ohashi.
Woo!
The tour will also allow Biles to join forces with former UCLA coach Valerie Condis Field.
Oh my gosh!
Condis Field, who retired last spring, will serve as executive producer and supervising choreographer for the tour.
So cool.
I get chills.
So
full body chills.
Freaking cool.
Biles said, "We want this to be completely different. There will be dancing, hopefully trampoline, something people have never seen before. I feel like everyone's creative vision coming together is very unique." So,
wow.
USA Gymnastics typically coordinates a post-Olympic tour of its own, though there are no plans for one in 2020. The organization remains in bankruptcy court as it tries to reach a resolution with athletes who are sexually abused by former national team doctor Larry Nassar, who abused gymnast Biles included, under the guise of treatment.
Wow.
So Biles captured 5 gold medals at the 2019 World Championships to boost her career total to 25 medals overall, a record for both men and women. She is widely considered the greatest gymnast of all time. Observant sparklers will note that the Gold Over America Tour shares the acronym of greatest of all time, which Simone Biles certainly is. But also,
awesome.
I think it's amazing that she is putting something together. They were talking about changing the culture and changing the game.
Amazing.
And they're essentially like USA Gymnastics.
Like, we'll do this ourselves.
You're out.
That's right.
You're done.
You're done.
Retire. I'm not for cancel culture. I'm not for it.
Except that we just canceled them, but that's fine.
It was a case where I was like,
you're canceled.
I was like, take back the culture.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'm so excited about that.
Incredible.
Can we go see that?
Yes, can we really? My God, yes. Let's do it.
Barres had an idea where he was like, what if you do a town hall where you do a spark file with those? I was like, that would be amazing.
Michael.
We could do it at town hall.
Michael, what a great idea.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was exciting news. What else
super,
is shaken?
Super, super, super exciting.
It's been really gratifying when people write to us and let us know that after our workshops, they created the thing that they aimed to
make. It's so thrilling.
So one of our attendees from the Performing Arts Project created a podcast called Artversations that she declared she was going to make when we worked with her this past summer.
That's right.
And she totally did it.
That's right.
And the hits just keep on coming.
Thrilling.
I just subscribed to it this morning. I'm super excited.
Oh my gosh. I need to.
This is just a few.
Yeah.
This is a handful.
Yeah, yeah.
One of our Miranda family fellows declared that they were going to make this piece of basically a protest performance, and they did it and sent the video. And
I was amazing.
So it's so gratifying to see people generate ideas about things they're going to make in the workshop and then
actually do it.
Send us the thing.
To follow through.
They do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited about it.
I am too.
Yeah. Good stuff. Anything else we need
to...
What you got?
No, I mean, yes, well, I'm ready to go.
You're ready?
I'm so ready to share some spark.
This day is my favorite day.
It's
spark
thrilling.
Day.
Yeah, so I'm ready.
All right. I'm going to go.
You're going to go first.
Okay.
I'm ready to listen.
And here we go.
Okay.
So sources for my spark include an article in the Chicago Tribune by a writer named Ali Marotti, a video produced by Right Way Signs of Chicago, an article, audio story, and video produced by WBEZ. Someone named Liz Stanton is working on a great series called Curious City. And so good work, Curious City. A YouTube video produced by the user Type Ed, a video produced by USA Today with reporting by Boyd Hoopert of KARE in Minneapolis. I think I'm mispronouncing all the names today, but my apologies. So my spark this week is actually a visual, Cams. I'm going to show you something, and I want you to describe to the people what you see. This, don't be nervous.
Wait, I need my glasses.
Let me put on my glasses.
What's this now?
What do you see?
Hang on.
It's not, yeah.
Oh, it's like a supermarket signage for ground chuck. It's for beef.
Great.
Also some fruit, mangoes, oranges. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. Grocery store signs.
Grocery store signs.
Sorry, that was not me farting. That was the sound of me turning my iPad around.
Who farted?
So, who farted? So when I was little, I had this little mini obsession with hand-drawn grocery store signs.
Really?
Yeah. There was a supermarket near our house called Liberals. It's long gone. It's now a vacant lot. But back then, they always had these big glass windows, and they were always filled with hand-drawn signs and advertisings for the current specials. And I was obsessed by the signs.
Hand-drawn? Why? It's just faster?
I loved the way they looked and the precision of the lettering. I didn't really register the prices. My mom was fantastic at knowing who had the lowest price. Like, whose bananas were more affordable that week.
Yeah.
I didn't give a shit about that. I was obsessed with the design and the signage. And because all I've ever wanted in life ever is to go backstage and see how the sausage is made, to mix my metaphors. I wondered, even as a little kid, I wondered who drew those signs and where were they drawing them. I liked making posters for school. I liked art and art class. And I wondered if that could be a job for me one day.
Oh my gosh, what a great idea
for
a job.
I was obsessed. As a kid, I made up a story. I imagined that the person who made the signs was also a supermarket employee, like the butcher, who was also really good at drawing. But I think I was misguided.
Oh, God.
I think it was probably a professional whose entire trade and craft was producing signs. And that's what I want to talk about today, the art of hand-lettered grocery store signs.
Yeah.
This may be the most niche spark
yet.
Niche, but man, from a young age, this sparks me.
Are people still doing it today?
Camion,
You got to tell me.
You got to let me spark this spark, girl. That's so funny.
I'm going to assume they are.
Didn't you say in a recent episode, why must I lay out my spark for
my
you?
My most defensive moment ever. Like, why do I have to outline it? Yeah.
I don't want to
Sorry about that moment.
That's okay. There's always that fear. We're curious and we have questions, but we don't want to like bust.
You can't
each
jump
other.
Ahead. Yeah. I know you have a plan for this.
We'll get to it. So anyone can call this work what they want, a trade, a craft, but I think hand-lettered grocery store signs are really an art. And things like large format digital and vinyl letters and printing, digital signs have changed the game significantly, but there are still some folks who are doing the work by hand and keeping yeah. this art form alive.
Yeah.
According to a lecture I watched produced by Type Ed and featuring a seasoned grocery store sign painter named John Downer, there are three cities that are still producing a fair number of hand-drawn or painted grocery store signs: New York, Boston, and Chicago. But I will tell you, I found some legendary handmade sign makers in other places too, places like Minneapolis and Toronto. Downer says that there are also some great grocery store sign makers in Mexico City. But for a moment, I would like to focus on Chicago.
Susan, can I pause for one second?
Yeah.
Because I know you're going to get to this, I'm sure.
Will I?
But I'm already like, what happens to those signs? Because, you know, the price of beef is going to go up.
Yeah.
Do they just throw them out? And how can you get your hands on them?
I am going to get to that.
Okay.
So lightly, because I don't know that I know all of the answers.
Yeah, so curious.
Because there's probably a lot of answers to that question, but I know some of the answers.
Okay. So Chicago.
Travel with me
to
the city of broad shoulders. Is that what they're called?
I don't know.
The
I've
second
never
city,
heard that.
The meatpacking city, the windy city.
Oh, the meatpacking city. Wow.
Settle down. So according to sign paper, Bob Bahownik, Chicago's been known for the last 120 some years as the sign capital of the world.
Huh.
According to Bob Bahownik. Indeed, in Chicago, there are still sign makers making these iconic signs fresh each week at places like Southwest Signs, where expert painters carry on a tradition of hand-painted advertising signs for Chicago area supermarkets, grocery stores, and hot dogs. This is all from a piece that WBEZ did, Liz Stanton. Great
wow.
work.
Wow.
These are her words. You walk into the back of the shop and right away, a heavy scent hits you and reminds you of the company's roots. Paints and brushes lay stacked on the counter, covered with Technicolor drippings. Two long tables, stretch along the length of the shop's back room with a roll of white paper at the end. It starts with the paper. They cut it, then they paint fat squiggly lines across the top and bottom borders, framing the center, and then they add on the price and the item, and it's straight from the can of paint onto the paper.
Wow.
No tracing.
Wow.
Just smooth hand strokes. And watching the paint covered brushes glide across that paper can feel hypnotic. Those are Liz Stanton's words, but I'm going to tell you, those words are true. It is mesmerizing.
Wow.
They use what is known as the Chicago style. And the Chicago style uses this sort of purpley blue, bright red, and then either chartreuse or chrome yellow. And the way that they paint the characters is this very big, very blocky, very distinct Chicago look.
Mm-hmm. That was the one you just showed me that I'm sure we'll share on Instagram. Was that Chicago?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. And I'll show you more.
Yeah.
So that classic Chicago look is something that longtime sign painter Bob Bahownik says spread across the country after sign painters came to learn and paint in Chicago during the 40s, 50s, and 60s, which is why I might recollect it from my childhood in Ohio, and you might recognize it from your years in Kansas.
Yes.
A lot of these paper sign makers may have been trained in the same city mm-hmm. and some at the same schools of lettering.
Very cool.
So Chuck Wilmarth is one of the painters at Southwest Signs. And Camion, we have to post a video of him working, watching the way that he paints, no tracing, ugh, no rulers, no stencils, but with this certainty and precision and flow. The way that he drags the paint, the speed and the efficiency with which he works, it is a thing to behold. And it's critical for him to be successful at this work, to keep up with the volume and the quick turnaround that's required.
All I can think right now is this may be, in a contest of underappreciated art forms, this may be up there as one of the winners. That like people just don't think about. You take it for, you go to the grocery store, mm-hmm. you're not thinking about the artistry, mm-hmm. the skill or the talent mm-hmm. that went into those signs.
Yeah, we'll return to this thought.
Okay,
because
awesome.
I'm like, let's think about it. Mm-hmm. Let us open our eyes and mm-hmm. think about it. So the grocery stores are typically advertising their perishables on those signs. Not always, but a mm-hmm. lot. Like the mm-hmm. meat, the vegetables and stuff like
things
that.
Things that gotta move.
Things
they can't
that
sit on
have
the
to move. Yeah. And their loss leaders, that they're like super low yep. prices that they're taking a loss on just to get people in the door. They're trying to beat the ticking clock and get the perishable food sold while they still can. And they're trying to beat the prices of their competitors even by a penny.
Wow.
So it's the same for grocery stores, hot dog stands, fish markets. And there's also huge confidentiality around the work that the sign makers do, because if they receive the order,
that's right.
They can't, another competitive grocer can't know that they've slid it in with bananas one penny per pound.
That's right.
I am fascinated by the way that the form has been dictated by necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Every part of the signs, which are called knockout signs, mm-hmm. have been refined over time for maximum impact. Chuck Wilmarth of Southwest Signs told the Chicago Tribune, "When the car is driving down the street at 30 miles per hour, what do you want to know? My wife always wants to know what's on sale. We really try to think about the layout of the signs, and you have those keywords pop and you have the prices pop." So it's all driven Boom. By necessity.
Perfect.
And it's been honed over time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just like, it's just perfection. Another legend of the field is Chess Perry. He's a lead sign painter and mural artist at Right Way Signs. And in the 80s and 90s, before the computer took over and hand-painted signs were more prevalent, he'd spend like 12-hour days, one day each week, painting paper signs for grocery stores. Typically, he says the stores would call in their sign orders on Wednesday, he'd paint all day on Thursday, and then he'd deliver them all Friday morning when the sales usually started for the weekend.
Wow.
So there was a real peak to this work
That's
has since changed. But
I could imagine that the speed with which you could do this might, especially like when printing first started, like you couldn't print things as fast as you could have someone quickly paint them.
That's right.
So if you need to get a sale going,
and
real
that may
fast,
still be the case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the Chicago Tribune article I read, Chess was in the midst of painting three paper advertisements at one time, boop, 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 for the Fish Keg in the West Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago. Fish Keg manager Monty Williamson says they've been using Chess Perry's hand-painted signs since Perry first had his own shop. Perry has also paints the eatery's menu signs. He's done murals on its walls. The signs are quick and they can keep up with the ever-changing fish specials. In a world where computer-generated signs now dominate, the hand-painted versions are better at catching the eyes of the passersby.
Yes.
And the Fish Keg manager said, I love the Fish Keg. Can
fish
we go
keg,
to the Fish Keg
on.
For lunch?
Yes.
The Fish Keg manager said, it's amazing how the signs draw people in. It gives you a warmer feeling. I guess it's almost like, do you want to have a frozen TV dinner or do you want your mazho baked?
All right.
You want your mazho baked.
We totally know the answer to that question.
So I watched this video produced by Right Way Signs, which is sign painter Chess Perry and his son. It's their business. And he said how every sign painter has their own signature style. And at the height of the pre-digital sign making era, he could look at any Chicago sign and tell you exactly who painted it.
Wow.
He actually got into the business by accident. He wanted to go to school for commercial design, what we now call graphic design. He got accepted into a Chicago school. He showed up on the first day and learned it was actually a school that only taught letter design and sign painting. So he literally thought he was going to graphic design school.
What?
Showed up on the first day. You know, this is pre-internet. This is,
yeah.
you know, this kid
yeah.
trying to make his way in the world. Showed up on the first day and learned he was going to be practicing lettering for 3 years. Day in and day out for the next 3 years. He said he kind of liked it, so he stuck with it. This guy, Chess Perry,
this
is the most...
not bad.
He is the most
this.
Like... He is a laid-back, casual dude. He literally practiced hand lettering in different styles a couple of days each week, all day long, for years. And through that regular, consistent practice, developed his own lettering style. He remarked that unless younger people get away from a computer, it would be very difficult for them to develop their own style, and I'll add, maybe even just cultivate this skill in the first place.
That's right.
Because the people that do this don't have 10,000 hours. They have 10 million hours. Like,
well, keep in mind, like, handwriting isn't even taught the way that it used to be. Cursive isn't taught. Yeah. So, you know, they had the basis for...
Can I tell you that I wrote something in cursive and somebody who had not been taught cursive said, I don't know how to read that.
Oh my God.
And I was like...
Are they like, were they 20-ish?
Who is a grandma now? They were young.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy moly.
I have feelings I don't know how to express right now.
My feeling is
I don't want to shame anyone who was not.
I'm not putting shame on them. I'm thinking about how fucking old I am.
No, I know. I know. Well, first of all, you're not old. But second of all.
But you should be ashamed of yourself.
No, I'm saying I don't. But there's not shame on them. It's shame on our education system. And I have obsessed. Like, I think I didn't know how to say this because, like, I have been obsessed with this idea for a long time. The concept of, like, this is a huge moment in history.
Yeah.
There are documents no one will be able to read. Not just your grandma's little sweet little letters to you that you won't be able to read.
Scholars and but it won't be as accessible. But, in the same way though, I can't look at something that some monk lettered back in the day and I can't read it.
Of course not.
I can barely read where the S's look like F's.
But it's just so a moment confusing. To recognize like this mark
change.
Of delineation from this point forward, we will need scholars to read grandmother's letters.
But this is a different, there's a different spark in here for a different day, but there's also, I think, a fair amount of research around how handwriting versus typing on a computer really does activate a different part of the brain.
Absolutely.
Which I bemoan because my handwriting has really gotten bad.
Mine's illegible. As you know.
I disagree. You have nice handwriting.
I used to have really nice. It's now.
Same here.
I am, listen, in this creativity challenge that we're doing right now.
Yeah, you've been handwriting
every
day.
I've been like, okay, I'm writing.
Is your hand going to fall off at the end of the month?
It's not going to, but when I'm
it's not going to fall off.
I take a picture and I'm like, you know, conscious of like, oh, I don't want anyone to
read it,
be able
but
to
you're
see
like,
it.
No worries.
And then I look closely at it. I'm like, no one could fucking decipher this if they wanted to.
So there's a benefit to it.
That's right.
But back to the spark.
That's
so,
right.
Chess's son, Alex, is his partner in Right Way Signs. And he says he thinks people are sort of exhausted by digital signage and things printed on a machine, and that hand-painted signs have imperfections and a human touch that give them a distinct appeal, and that even if the same sign painter did three versions of the same sign for you, they would still not be identical. Like there's a human touch to it.
Who's that quote from? Chester?
That's from Chess's son, Alex, who's also a sign painter.
I love these guys.
These guys are such interesting guys.
Ugh.
Yeah. So in Chicago, these hand-painted grocery store signs used to be the norm, like everywhere. And that's because small grocery stores were everywhere. Before large format digital printing came along, like I said earlier, everything that needed to be read from a distance, they were being made by these sign makers. But the hand-painted business obviously has shrunk dramatically over the years. The Chicago-based family-run Southwest Signs was hit hard during the last recession, and they said all of these mom-and-pop stores went under right away, and that's who we would do signs for. Southwest Signs has managed to survive by diversifying. They bought a large-format digital printer, and digital-focused orders revved up in the past 5 years, but today the hand-painted paper sign orders make up only about 10% of their work.
Of their whole business. Yep. But thank God, like, I'm so thankful that they did not just wipe out that business.
Yes.
Some people would. They would say, wow, you're putting a whole lot into 10% of your business.
If it is sort of like a dying business and these guys are aging out and somebody's not literally taking up the mantle and taking up the brush and the pen.
That's right.
It it does become a dying art form.
Reminds me of Par Puzzles because, literally were like, I don't
who
have an
can,
heir to take
can,
this on.
Yes.
And someone did, thankfully.
Luckily. There is a reason to keep going. The The owner of a family-owned market in Chicago says that he can predict what would happen if they stopped putting their brightly painted signs in the windows of their store. Customers would think we are shutting down.
Whoa.
Yeah, like if they change now, he's like, it's so much a part of their identity.
Yes.
Customers would think that the store was closing, which I thought was fascinating. This is again from the WBEZ piece. I do maintain hope that the paper signs, though they will never be a majority market share in Chicago, they will always have a role to play because they do something that no other type of sign can do.
Yeah.
And I feel that way. I think that's right.
I also want to commend the store owner for recognizing that. I can't tell you, having dabbled in marketing in my whole life, I can't tell you the number of people who would not recognize that brand connection between these signs and what people know and think about the store.
Yeah.
They're, you know, some new upshot walking in being like, these cost too much. We can do this cheaper. We could print these in-house, whatever. A million different people with a million different decisions. But if it's a
chain store, there's no way a chain store. It really has to be about, there is a chain store. This is not my spark, but in my research, there was a chain grocery store, big one, big market leader in Chicago called Jewel's. Mm-hmm. And they
still do it?
They started doing it again.
Awesome.
How about that?
That's awesome.
I am struck by the flow state that these makers are in when they are rocking this work. It really is their life's work, and it is so deeply embedded in their muscle memory. And man, can they paint fast and can they paint accurately? One piece I read said, there are no erasers in the hand-painted sign business. Each mistake is lost money and sometimes, more importantly, lost time. Mm-hmm. Another video I watched from KARE told the story of a sign maker in Minneapolis named Randy Mueller, who was preparing to retire at 75. And in the segment, they talk about how the sign maker's brain would take a nap and he'd actually begin to fall asleep while his hands kept painting.
Wow.
And at that point, Randy Mueller had been painting for 55 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Someone needs to do like a neurological study on their brains. That would be fascinating.
Well, I feel like anybody who has, whether you're a cobbler, whether you're somebody who does
it's a repetitive motion.
Yes. Yeah. And if you've done it for 55 years, I think it must be transcendent.
Wow.
Yeah. A bit about the technique. Each sign painter seems to have their own approach and their own style. Randy Mueller, who I was just talking about, who could sleep and make signs at the same time, his apprentice who had been working with him for 17 years when Randy retired, his apprentice recalled Randy teaching him the craft and saying, the brush was like a tractor pulling a semi-trailer, which I think would make the line of paint the semi-trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Most support their painting hand in some way. So sometimes, listeners, you can't see what I'm doing, but they'll rest their painting hand on their other hand.
Mm-hmm.
Some do a technique that I heard one sign maker called pinky down, where they're resting their pinky on the surface and then they're painting the letter with their fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Or some use what's called a mall stick, which is sort of, if you can picture like an aluminum cube stick from pool. And then on the end, picture like a ball, and it could be plastic wrapped or it could be like a plastic ball. When I first saw it, it almost looked like a big Q-tip.
Mm-hmm.
And they rest the stick on the surface and then they rest their hand on the stick.
Mm.
And then they're also holding the palette with paint on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their, and so they're using it as to steady their hand, but they're also using it to guide their hand. And sometimes I think they're using it almost as a level so that if they're painting, so they're working with the geometry of the way the mall stick sits against the letter that they're making to make sure that it's all in alignment. Watching it is...
I can't wait to see these videos.
But some, like Chuck Wilmarth of Southwest Signs, simply seem to freehand it. So it's just paper. It's just the paper. And then he's just got his brush loaded with paint. And he is just the beauty of a straight line painted with a hand that's done it 10 million
times.
A
straight line with a steady hand.
I'm telling you, it really, it just really is thrilling to me.
You're perspiring.
I am. So, so John Downer is an American journeyman sign painter, a typeface designer, and a logo designer. He began his career as a sign painter in the late 60s. And in the video I watched, he taught a day of lettering paper signs to the sign graphics department at the Los Angeles Trade Tech College. Their sign graphics program is the last remaining trade school in the country with a full-blown hand lettering program. So while there may have been many at one point, now there's theirs. Mm-hmm. Sidespark, it struck me, and I'm sure it's become apparent to you, Camian, and you listeners, that most of these sign makers are men. Not all, but much of this work has been passed down from father to son or from man to man. Mm-hmm. And I have thoughts about that, but we'll get to it.
But, I mean, isn't that primarily because of when it originated?
Probably, but now I'm like, we're here now. And I know
that
the culture is changing, but
some of your daughters getting in there.
I have pure confidence that there would be women who are genius at this. So,
that's right. Yep.
Anyway, John Downer described starting out and working shoulder to shoulder with other sign makers, and it wasn't fussy. There wasn't ego involved because you were just cranking out these giant signs. So John would do the big price numbers, and then the sign would slide. Mm-hmm. The next guy would do the product names, and then the sign would slide, and the next guy would do any additional text. John laid out some do's and don'ts for this big, fast grocery store sign painting. Don't get too fussy. If you get too fussy, you won't make money. In the sign painter's culture, you do not stack letters on top, like one right on top of each other. But John seemed to have strong ideas, and I've seen some sign painters stack letters. I'm just saying.
But is that because it's less legible as you're driving by the supermarket?
Potentially, and it might be because it's harder to make it all align accurately. Mm-hmm. So it may highlight imperfections, potentially. He didn't say why. He just said, don't do it. Do not use serifs. Takes too much time. Mm. So that's, we're just doing classic blocky letters, no extra doodly-doos. Mm-hmm. No shading, no stencils, no graphics. Do not place tape diagonally across the corner of the paper when you tape it to your work easel. It will tear when you're trying to lift the sign off the page. Don't do it, Camian. Here's some do's.
I'm stopping today.
Do use time-saving abbreviations. Spuds instead of potatoes, for instance. If you want to do a misted or spotted background, you can use a spray can. You can take some latex paint and just splatter it for a little splash behind.
A little pop.
Yep. Do use a combination of upright and slanted letters, right? So if your prices are upright, then maybe your product name is italicized. Mm-hmm. Use about 60% of the usable signage area for the price. Again, the price has to be read across the parking lot, across the street.
Wow.
60% of the usable signage area, that's going to be the price.
Wow.
I love this spark.
I do too.
What has been made of this? What has been made of this spark?
Oh.
Well, first of all, lots and lots of signs.
Lots of signs.
So many signs.
Iconic signs.
Careers. So that retiring sign maker in Minneapolis, Randy Mueller, the one who would practically fall asleep while working and his hands would still keep making signs, he worked alongside a younger sign maker named Patrick Moran right up until his retirement. He hired Patrick 17 years earlier. When he advertised the job in the paper, he included the words, "not college bound." Patrick had a learning disability, and his classmates called him dumb, like out loud. His classmates called him dumb,
what?
And he had to do special education. But Randy said Patrick was probably the best sign painter he ever worked with. And when he sold his shop and retired, his one stipulation was that Patrick was kept on by the new owner.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, Patrick actually, first of all, just seemed like the dearest heart and a hell of a sign maker.
Holy crap.
And he gave me hope because he was a young man doing this work.
Yeah.
And doing it really well. And I thought, Patrick will carry the torch forward.
Mm-hmm.
I did get a little worried because this was from a video that was produced a few years back, and I couldn't find the sign company where he had worked. Like, I really tried to find him and and see that he was still there. And I couldn't even, it was a very small business.
Yeah.
Patrick, wherever you are, I hope that you're still doing this work and I hope you're still making signs because your work is wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'll be on the lookout. What's his last name?
Patrick Moran.
Patrick
I couldn't
Moran.
Find him.
Okay.
Art. You make art out of this. A famous Toronto discount store named Honest Ed's. Not a grocery store, but it was a discount store. And their interior of the store was covered in hand-lettered signs advertising sales. But there were also tons of puns about how low the prices were. Like, it was like, Honest Ed is so clumsy, he keeps dropping prices. Like, lots of... Yeah. But literally every surface of this store was covered with handmade signs. And they were also hanging, if you can picture it, from clip hangers above the racks. So it'd be like, ladies fake fur coats, $79.99. And they were all handmade and they were everywhere. And they were made by just two or three guys working full time. And when they couldn't store all the signs, and eventually, ultimately, when the store went out of business, they would sell these old signs. And people, they were so iconic to the store. People would line up. The store was an entire city block in Toronto and covered in neon. It looked like a bag of bananas. It was amazing. But people would line up around the block so that they would hopefully have a chance to buy one of these hand-lettered signs, limit 8 per customer.
Oh.
And I looked it up. A few of them are listed on eBay and Etsy, and they're selling for hundreds of dollars.
Oh, my God.
So you make art out of it.
That's right.
What do we make out of it, Cams? Like I said earlier, I'd love to see more diversity in the world of sign painters. And it's hard for me to believe that only male identifying hands can letter great signs.
For real.
So I don't mean to invite you all into, like a dying art form, but I would love to see more women sign makers in general, frankly.
Oh my God. Keep it alive.
What do we make of it? We make a practice of it. In another life, if when I have a little more free time, I would love to practice hand lettering. I don't think I would be great at it, but I do think I would take great pleasure in doing this work, if only for my own satisfaction. These people all have 10 million hours, and watching their hands work with so much detachment is so magnificent. But maybe I could, from time to time, maybe we could, listeners, give the computer a fucking break and just hand lettering a little bit more.
Why am I thinking of garage sale signs and estate sale signs?
I am thinking of that too.
And like, yeah, put a little energy into that. Put a little effort into that. Let us help us read it when we're driving by.
Big prices. Bam. I see art. I'm also wondering if there's, I started looking for local sign makers who, if I could say, okay, I want a quote-unquote grocery store sign, and it could be on paper, but I want it to say this instead. Can you knock that out for me?
Yeah.
Can you knock out that knockout sign for me?
Did you find anyone who could?
I'm not sure about New York, but Chicago is rocking it pretty hard. And I also was like, if I can get in touch with Patrick Moran, I would happily.
Patrick,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah. But I
just feel like not all other, but there's so many art forms that are having a resurgence with makers who want to get to the.
I want to put this on that docket.
Yeah.
If you're creating a play or a movie that you want to set in Chicago, these signs scream Chicago, especially the ones I was describing. Mm-hmm. Characters. If you are looking to act or write some great motherfucking characters, watch as many interviews as you can with professional sign letterers. They are characters, one and all. And they even talk about how they're all characters.
Incredible.
Amazing.
What a great idea. I'm already like, a short film. I have some
beautiful
thoughts.
Documentary, make a short documentary, make a long documentary. There is a documentary about sign makers, and there are some women sign makers in that. I could not find one about grocery store sign makers. Am I the only audience for this? I don't know.
I'm here for it.
This is a show about striking flint to rustle up some creative sparks. But another thing that sparked me from all of this, the thing that it made me think of is mindfulness and curiosity. Mm. As you move through the world, when you see a handmade thing, whether that's a sign, a piece of woodwork, a piece of pottery, an item of clothing, maybe just start asking yourself, whose hands made that?
Mm.
Whose mind's eye visualized that in the first place? Even if it's something we're accustomed to, something that is so common to our eyes that we just grazed past it, something really, really common, like hand lettered grocery store signs.
Yes.
And that is my spark.
Oh, Susan, what a great spark.
I'm so excited to share it.
Oh, that was really good.
Thanks.
That was really, really good.
I've been cooking
that up for decades. Oh, well, delish.
Shall we take a break?
Oh, yeah. Awesome. The spark fire! Susan, I'm still like on a little high from that. That was amazing.
Grocery store sign high.
All right. Well, I'm going to funnel all this energy into my spark. My sources include NPR, All Things Considered.
Nice.
And the New York Times, a 1999 article by Jenny Lynn Bader. And a few others that I'll mention along the way.
Take it back to 1999.
That's right. Turn of the century. Oh, God. Speaking of old, we can now say there was a turn of the century.
Oh, my gosh. You know,
because remember, I thought of that. There was a spark we were doing, and I was talking about
which
the
turn of the century.
And you were like, wait, sorry, which one? I was like, oh.
The old one.
The old one. Okay. Well, Susan, you know that I'm a fan of estate sales.
Yes.
Right? You know this?
I know that estate sales
can, like, for some people, I think they can bring up like mixed emotions, because the fact of the matter
are the two emotions awesome and awesome?
Awesome and awesome. No, I think if you think about it, there are very few good reasons why someone is having or maybe having an estate sale.
I plan on having one when we downsize.
I plan
to be healthy and alive and have an estate sale.
That's right.
Yeah.
So typically, you know, if the contents of an entire home are being sold, it's typically because someone died.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's because people are getting divorced and selling all their assets. And occasionally someone is downsizing and going to live in a tiny house or backpack through Europe or something without all their stuff. And that's fine. But when you go to a lot of estate sales, you realize...
We know what's happened.
We know what's happened here. And, you know, mostly it's because someone has died. So there was a time when it kind of creeped me out a little bit, but then mostly I focus on the fact that all this stuff
you
is
love
just
cool
stuff.
Shit.
I love cool stuff, and this is just stuff.
And it gives it another life.
That's right.
Yeah.
Someone's going to pick through my stuff after I'm gone, and I'm okay with
that. And that someone is me.
That is Susan Blackwell.
And then I'm going to collect the insurance money.
I need to tell Wes that you get like an entire first day of the estate sale to just pick... Susan's going to be picking, and then it can open up
to
the public.
Is this where we revealed that I texted you last week and I was like, I'm filling out my will. What do you want?
She did. She
can
really
did. Can you remind
did.
Me? That painting
has my name on it.
The two weird girls.
Mm-hmm.
You want the table chandelier?
I've got to have the table
chandelier.
There was
chandelier. One more thing. You picked up
no,
one
you
more thing.
No, you denied it. You denied it.
What was
I'm
it?
I'm not going to bring it up again because it'll hurt my feelings.
Was it POTUS? What did you want?
No, but you said you had my name on two things.
I do. I have it on another painting, but what was the other thing?
It was a terrarium, but I don't want to talk again about how I killed that
Use
plant.
Use it as a candle holder.
Great.
You can put candles in it.
Yes.
All right. Sold.
Okay, great.
Okay, great.
All right. So we've worked that out. I'm glad. But you will get first dibs. You and my nieces and my nephew. So you might actually have to race them in there. It's the four of you I'm imagining scrounging
put
through
it
the
in
house.
A I'm slow.
So anyway, I do imagine someone will go through my stuff, and I hope that they like squeal with delight when they find some little treasure that brought me joy during my days on earth, you know? So when Wes and I first settled in Florida, we chose this mid-century home to live in, and the only furniture that really felt right inside of it was mid-century.
That's right.
So estate sales were great for that, obviously. Because many people of a certain age who are passing on, they might still have items from when they furnished their home in the 50s or the 60s.
Yes.
That's right. The OG. And it's so fun to find these rare items. Or maybe they traveled a lot, so you find strange and awesome artifacts from their travels. Because keep in mind, back then, like, traveling A was not so common, and B, you couldn't just order anything off the internet. So someone, if you found a little treasure from Africa, it is because someone went to Africa and came back with
That's right.
You know, they didn't just order that up. So anyway, I delight in going and poking around and being sparked by things I've never seen before. That's my favorite thing. Just looking and being like, what is this? What is it used for?
What are you?
What are you? And what could you be now? Could I like reinvent you into something else? So
can I say one thing I've done that with?
Yeah.
I don't think we've ever talked about this. I also share this passion with you. I was teaching down in Florida, and as is my wont, visiting several thrift stores, and I found a camel saddle that someone had brought back as a souvenir from the Middle East.
Yes.
And I even had to ask, I was like, what is this? And the woman that was working at the register said, we believe it's a souvenir camel saddle. And immediately I was like, oh yes, you put blankets over the hump of the camel. You rest this wooden structure in it. It's padded ideally, and then you can ride a camel.
Yeah.
But I brought it home, cut a tabletop for it, covered the tabletop with leather, and put those little hobnail screws.
Yeah.
And I made a beautiful little occasional table out of
it. It is so beautiful. We need to put a picture up of it.
I really do enjoy, and I'm not somebody who will bring something home and then not get her done.
Yeah.
I get her done.
You're like, I gotta,
and
yeah,
I love
I'm
it.
Do something.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Pridefulness is a sin. Go ahead.
No, you know, like I used to go and find vintage linens because I used to make these tops.
That's right. You would take vintage aprons and make the cutest halter tops.
That's right. That's right. I did. I just loved doing it and combining, like they used to make just such cute linens, like with like souvenir linens.
Adorable.
That might have a map of Florida.
Graphics.
Yeah,
and
super
gorgeous.
Cool.
Yeah,
so fun. But yeah, it's like fun to poke around through all of these things that people have left behind and reimagine them, or just imagine what they were for originally. It's really interesting. But another thing that people leave behind is unfinished artwork.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I knew I'd get a deep breath out of you. Like creative projects that they started and for whatever reason they never finished. So this week, thanks to my friend Sarah Shives.
Oh.
Hi Sarah.
Hi Sarah. Love Sarah Shives.
Hi Sarah. I was alerted to a story about a woman who purposefully goes to estate sales, finds cross-stitch patterns and projects that were left unfinished. She buys them and she completes them. How cool is that?
I feel like somebody else sent me this and I didn't have time to explore the spark.
Well, what's really interesting is that I dug a little deeper. This woman is the woman who runs Badass Cross-Stitch on Instagram. And I follow her. I already follow her.
So you were familiar with her work?
Yes, but not that. I didn't realize she was going to estate sales and doing that.
Yeah.
I was just familiar with her work.
Of her work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she makes these creations that juxtapose this like sweet looking old fashioned art form, like cross stitch.
Yes.
With sort of current and modern feminist of the moment type expressions.
You know, I am all about putting a monster in it, as I call it.
Awesome.
I love putting a monster in it.
Put a monster in it.
That's right.
So what she does, like she might have like a hoop, like cross stitch hoop.
Hold on. I feel like I should clarify when I say putting a monster in it, just to clear it up. I mean, I don't know if I've ever said this on here. I like to get paintings from the thrift store and like landscapes and put a monster in it.
That's right.
That's what
paint
I mean by that.
Monster in it.
Okay.
But that's right.
I love this. The old meeting the new. I love it.
I love it too. And what she's doing is really, to me, it's fascinating. I love putting a monster in it too. She's not putting a monster in it, but she is.
But she's taking an old, ye oldie craft.
That's
and
right.
She is putting a new spin on it.
That's right. So like her little hoop might say things like, it might say boys will be boys, and then crossed out, instead she'll stitch like boys will be held accountable for their fucking actions. So, or she might write like the black sheep of the family is often just the one tagging out of toxic bullshit.
Oh.
And I fucking love this because Fantastic. It's so surprising to see what she puts on these hoops or these little vintage linens, because we're so conditioned to think like visually, we're like, oh, that's going to say home sweet home or call your mother or something. And instead, like, it sends a shock to
something
the system.
Something subversive. I
yeah,
love it.
I really, really love it. So to find out that she does this too, like, it just blew my mind. Like, she finishes unfinished work for other people.
That
Come
is
on.
Satisfying.
It is so beyond.
For everybody. And she's got a leg up on whatever that project is.
Plus, I want to think, like, just pause for a second and think about how many people struggle to finish a creative project. And like, maybe they have a mental block. Maybe that just reinforces this idea of like, oh, I don't finish things. Look at this woman. She not only finishes her own shit, she finishes other people's shit. And I think that's such a powerful statement. Like, it's really empowering. She must have a real clear understanding of herself. Like, I finish it.
Yeah.
I get things done.
Yeah. That's amazing.
So I really love that about it. But this badass cross stitch woman has a name. Her name is Shannon Downey. She lives in Chicago.
Chicago trending. Yes.
She calls herself an artist, activist, craftivist, stitching fury into action, mobilizing community. And that is the truth. Recently, Shannon went to an estate sale. She found pieces of a quilt that was not made yet, but you know, the shapes had been cut out.
Do you know, I stock all of this on, and I don't know how to quilt and I barely know how to sew.
And you stock quilters?
I stock it on eBay. I stock vintage quilts and also unfinished quilt tops and quilt panels, quilt squares that have not been put together.
Squilt. I like that.
Squilts.
I like squilts.
That's a quilt square. That's what we call it, a squilt.
Well, is that true? No.
No.
We just made it up, though. Let's call it that now.
Hashtag
so
squilt.
I had no idea that you did that. It doesn't surprise me.
I just love looking at it.
It's an incredible skill, but I think you're going to like this story even more.
Camion, I love the spark.
So she went to an estate sale and she finds this bin and it's full of all these pieces, squilts. And she's like, oh, what are all these squilts? And
they're like, it's clearly marked squilts right on the side of the box in magic marker. Why are they from New England? Why are they the Pepperidge Farm guy?
I'm not sure because she...
It's clearly marked on the box.
So they were actually these hexagon panels.
Yeah.
And it was clear that it was going to be a quilt of all 50 states. Okay. So she has them all cut out. There were a few that were already embroidered with the outline of a state along with the state bird and the state flower. Like Alaska was done. Georgia was done. New Jersey was halfway done. But that was it. And the rest of the hexagons needed to be stitched. It needed to be sewn together. It was a
big
project. Shannon didn't balk. She bought the whole bin. She also bought a map of the U.S. that Rita had already finished embroidering.
Rita was the original quiltress?
That's right.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you more about Rita in a minute.
Great, great, great.
But she had already finished embroidering a map. And so she bought that map for like $5 as well. So she put a call out on Instagram for quilters. And more than 100 quilters answered the call. They traveled from around the country.
What?
They showed up in Chicago.
They had a quilting bee?
To help her finish the quilt.
In person?
In person. They looked up and researched the woman who began the quilt.
She's no dummy, though, because if you send that work out, it may never come back.
It may never come back.
All quiltresses and quilters, please report to the dance floor.
Immediately.
Sorry. I'm so sorry to interrupt.
No, no, no.
I'm so excited.
So they did.
So they all converge upon Chicago.
And they even like looked up who was this woman who had started it. Her name is Rita Smith. She was 99 years old when she passed away earlier this year.
Rita Smith.
They found her high school yearbook photo. They learned that Rita was a nurse and an avid crafter.
I love Rita.
So whenever anything was questioned, Shannon tried to imagine what Rita would have wanted.
What
would Rita do?
WWRD, baby.
She said, this is her art. We're just the hands.
Oh.
Okay. Right?
Love it.
So in a crafting workspace in Chicago called Wishcraft, all of these women came together and mirrored the long tradition of women getting together to sew and quilt. 7 hours later. 7 hours.
That's not a long time, though.
No, it is not.
In the life of a quilt.
That is so fast.
Yeah.
I thought that was so fast. The quilt embroidery was completed. It's 8 feet by 9 feet.
Oh, fabulous.
It will now go to a professional quilter to have the filling and the backing put on, and it'll be finished. And after that, it'll be shown locally in Chicago for a bit, but then it will end up at the National Quilting Museum in Paducah, Kentucky.
When are we going to
Paducah? Beginning in March. In March is when it will be there.
Unbelievable.
How cool is that? I mean, I doubt that Rita ever imagined.
I immediately go to a topic we have discussed on this podcast before, legacy. Rita has no idea. Well, maybe she does. Maybe she's looking down from quilter's heaven.
That's right.
Legacy.
Right?
What a beautiful thing to extend this to somebody.
That's what a gift, right? I love
And to Rita's family. If
this.
They.
I mean, right? Come on. I love this story so much. One of the other things that Shannon and the women who gathered together discussed while they were quilting is the lack of value that our culture puts on this type of creative work specifically. They felt and feel that it often isn't respected or valued as much as other art forms.
Huh.
Even the fact that Shannon only paid $5 for the embroidered map.
I was going to ask.
She knew that how much time Rita had put into that, how much skill, how much attention to detail.
Yeah.
And, you know, $5. So, I don't know. Shannon felt that it's due to the skills like sewing, quilting, embroidering. These have historically been considered women's work.
Yeah.
And they're treated like a little hobby rather than a form of artistry.
Yeah.
In the NPR story, several of the women discussed the fact that they didn't think their work was worthy of someone finishing when they die. And Shannon said, well, isn't that the point? Like, we don't even value our own work enough. And of course, Rita probably did not imagine that people are going to come in from around the country to finish the work that she started.
I gotta see this quilt.
So I'm not a quilter, but that resonated with me. And I wanted to bring it up on the Spark File, of course. Like, what parts of ourselves, or what stories are we holding back because we don't think they're worth sharing with the world? Do you remember that movie, like How to Make an American Quilt?
I do know it exists. I don't think I ever saw it.
It was based off a book by Whitney Otto. It had Winona Ryder, Alfre Woodard, Maya Angelou, Dermot Mulroney. My gosh, why can't
Dermot Mulroney.
Mulroney. I'm just going to cut him.
Just call him Dylan McDermott. We leave it all in and you call him Dylan McDermott.
Yes, it had this fantastic ensemble cast. We're just going to leave it, Dermot. Anyway, I remember this movie being kind of like buzzworthy at the time. And it was about this bond between women in this quilting circle and the tradition of women coming together to create quilts for young women at various milestones, like their wedding quilt, baby quilts for the little ones.
Is it a good movie? Do you recommend?
I don't think it was like the best, but I remember it, which is saying something.
Yeah.
Like I remember it from that time.
Because there are many things you don't remember.
There are many movies I don't remember seeing. My friends will be like, no, you saw that. I was with you.
We were sitting next to each other.
I was right there. And I'm like, oh, okay. But I remember that one. I think it did strike me, you know, this is well before the time we're living in now. So movies with female relationships that had substance were unique.
Yeah.
And this was, in fact, about female relationships. It was about handing down female stories from generation to generation. And I was struck by that. Like, in the movie, I think the young modern woman that is Winona kind of like rolls her eyes at the idea of this gathering of women, older ladies. And eventually she sees and feels the warm, loving embrace of their, you know,
American quilt.
Of their quilt. Yeah. Anyhow, I was remembering that movie, I think, as I was reading about Shannon. Yeah. The tradition, though, of women gathering to make quilts dates back till the 18th century. That's the 1700s for you, Susan.
Thank you.
Also known as the colonial era, like women shared the textile work out of necessity. So they would come together like everybody.
You're not saying that quilts didn't exist before then, are you?
The tradition of women coming together to make it together. So sharing of the labor, essentially.
God, I love that.
But there were a lot of things that actually were work parties, quote unquote parties. I'm using my fingers, parties that were a necessity and that we tend to feel a bit of nostalgia for, like barn raisings, the entire community, harvestings, huskings, and sewing and quilting parties.
Can I tell you just one funny side spark?
Mm-hmm. You can.
Oh, and we could cut it if this is totally pulling you off course, which I'm sure it will. We were on the subway. It was Halloween. And there is a wind-up that happens sometimes when you're on the subway where people are like, pardon me, ladies and gentlemen, excuse me. I'm sorry to interrupt your commute. I just want to ask you for some, if anyone has any money, anything to eat. And so the minute you hear, pardon me, ladies and gentlemen, excuse me, you just are like, oh, boy.
Okay.
That happened. Pardon me, ladies and gentlemen, excuse me. We're just trying to raise some money for a barn raising. And the whole subway car looked.
What?
And it was a group of people who for their Halloween costumes were dressed as Amish people.
Stop!
I have never seen a quicker pivot. The whole subway car burst into laughter. It's one of the funniest, bravest things I've ever seen.
Oh my God.
And they did it with like, it did it.
Straight face.
Straight face. And it seemed like they had done it 1,000,000 times professionally. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry to interrupt your commute. We're trying to raise money for our barn raising. And it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my
awesome.
Life.
That is awesome.
Anyway.
That is awesome.
I digress. You were saying.
Well, this whole topic got me thinking about collaboration and coming together socially.
I love this. Yes.
And maybe it feels lonelier now that we don't create collectively as much anymore. I mean, obviously, if you're working in theater, you're in a show, you're working collectively. But oftentimes you have to wait for those opportunities to arise. So one of my favorite things to sort of combat that feeling of aloneness is writing dates.
Yes.
I don't know if you have this.
Where you can even just sit next to each other and write.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I've done a bit of that. Yeah.
And typically, like, I learned a particular process from a screenwriting teacher I had named Ella Tier. She founded the Independent Film School. Susan has heard so much about
Ella. We talk about your work all the time.
But essentially, you meet, you create a little structure around it, but you meet, you share, what are you working on?
So it's sort of like collaborative writing, except you're not collaborating on the same project.
That's right. You're
just sort of like, if you're like, I'm going to get a coffee, do you want one? And you can sort of have a little bit of companionship and probably light accountability.
That's exactly it. So you meet, you see your friend, you chit chat for a minute, and then you just say like, okay, ready? What I'm working on is I'm trying to write this scene.
And if you're a maker who's an extrovert and you're working in a singular discipline, I can imagine how wonderful that would be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the, again, until you come together for the culmination of the theater project, most of the writing has been done by either a small group or one person alone before, 40 people come together and say, we made this.
Yeah.
So anyway, the process that Allah shares is that exactly that. So, you have a little bit of social time, then you say, I'm going to work on the climactic scene between my two main characters. What are you working on? I'm
going to
do this. Set the clock for an hour, write quietly. At the end of that, share. How did that go?
Oh, great. And who wants a coffee?
Who wants coffee? And then set it for another hour if you are willing to work that long. And so it goes.
What a great idea.
I love it. I personally love it. And when I need that human contact, it's essential. But I love the idea of quilting bees. But also, why not writing bees?
I love it.
Painting bees or dancing bees.
Can I add to this, Spark?
Mm-hmm.
My friend Kelly Picar has instituted this thing that she was doing with some frequency and regularity with a small group of like-minded people, and they called it Sunday Dunday. Mm-hmm. And they would just get together and just sit together, like at a table like this, and they would bring whatever it is they were had
needed to get done.
Yep.
Yes.
And they would just get it done.
Yes.
Next to each other.
I love it.
So that I remember her sharing that, and I was like, I love it.
I love it so much. Yes. Because sometimes you just need to
a little social time.
Date.
And then, mm-hmm. so you can do that solitary work together.
That's right.
I love it.
Anything to bring us together and enjoy that process of creating even more mm-hmm. togetherness. But the other topic that this story brought up for me is the idea of unfinished work.
Mm.
So there's some famously unfinished works that I wanted to mention. I'm sure there's a shit ton, frankly, that I'm not going to get to, but a couple that I wanted to mention. Some of the unfinished work is unfinished and remains so because of the story around it. So, for example, there's a very famous unfinished portrait of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Mm. I know you love the name Delano.
I do want to bring it back.
Mm. But FDR was on vacation in Georgia. He had a part-time like home there. They called the Little White House. He was there with his mistress, Lucy Mercer Rutherford. His mistress. And nice to be caught with your mistress when this happens. So that will forever go down in history. But he's with his mistress. She arranged for him to sit for a painting, for a portrait with a painter named Elizabeth Shumatov.
And a lady. Fantastic.
She was making him look pretty good because he was clearly kind of sick already.
Got it.
But you can see in the painting that he looks great. But on the second day of sitting for her, he experienced extreme pain in the back of his head and he collapsed and died 3 hours later. So the painting was never finished and it remains unfinished and it still hangs in the Little White House.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Famous and unfinished,
right?
Is
really?
Going to be the name of my autobiography.
Right, right. Or one of the most famous pieces of poetry. It begins...
In Xanadu
did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. Did you know that was an unfinished work?
I do, and I'm obsessed with this story.
This is so awesome.
The person from Porlock.
I don't know about Porlock.
I'll tell you in a second.
Okay. So this poem was written in 1797 by the renowned poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And Sam was a well-known user slash addict.
slash enjoyer. Enjoyer. Slash hobbyist.
slash addict of opium.
Yes.
And apparently the story goes that he fell asleep while reading a book about the Far East and supposedly dreamt the lines of the poem. And when he woke up, he wrote everything down as quickly as he could. Scribbled it down and he got like 50 lines down, but he had been imagining this was like a 300 line thing. He was getting it done. Was right there, clear as day. And an unexpected visitor shows up.
The person from Porlock.
Oh. Tell me about
him. There's a famous poem, and it might even be called The Person from Porlock, that I remember studying in graduate school about the person who interrupted Coleridge as he was writing.
Oh, God.
And it might have been a salesperson.
Fascinating.
I think it might have been a door-to-door salesperson.
Fascinating.
I could be full of beans, but I think
I think that's an incredible addition to the spark because that's just
it blows
layers
my mind.
On layers on layers because then, not surprisingly, Sam went back to finish after this visit, went back to finish
spark
and it was
gone.
That muse had left
that
him.
Spark left the building.
And he tried hard to get it back and to finish this poem and eventually got so frustrated he said, fuck it.
But that poem
lives on as quite possibly one of the most famous unfinished work in history.
I'm so happy that you're referencing this. I think about him waking up out of this dream state and writing this, and then the event of something so clear being interrupted. And I feel like that has happened to me maybe once or twice in my life. Not that I'm a hard drug user, but where I have something that has been so clear, suddenly you get interrupted or you get distracted and it's not so clear anymore. And this is why we always beg of you to get a spark file and get stuff in it, because these things that seem so indelible, They will leave you. Ephemeral, and they will slip through your fingers like Xanadu and Kubla Khan and a stately pleasure dome that they he decreed.
Will.
Yeah.
They will.
I love that.
Well, I love that story because I didn't know all of that. Some unfinished art, much like Rita's quilt, gets finished by someone else.
Hmm.
So perhaps the most famous is the unfinished classical piece by Mozart, Requiem,
okay.
which he died. There's a 20 million sparks around this because he died while he was writing this. Someone had, a mysterious person had commissioned it for a funeral for someone else. And Mozart went a little crazy thinking about his own death. And
that's a good spark.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Yeah.
But when he died, he had only fully orchestrated one movement of Requiem.
Got it.
Let me count them, 14.
Oh, no.
That's right.
That's so many movements.
So Franz Sassmayr, who some people say was an apprentice of his, some say he was an acquaintance of his. I don't really know what their relationship was, but he went on to finish the 9 incomplete movements, and then he wrote 4 more movements. And still, we credit the whole thing to Mozart.
You're kidding me.
No.
That's huge.
That's huge. And do you know Franz's name? No.
Never heard of it in my life.
Not one bit. It's kind of astonishing.
Orchestrations are one thing. Whole cloth composition.
That's right.
Not being credited with an ampersand to both of them. That seems crazy.
Maybe. I'm sure if people who know classical music are like, oh no, I know who Franz is. Great. But
for the regular lay person.
Yes, for the lay people
us. Fascinating.
Yeah. In architecture, the longest running incomplete project in recent times is the Sagrada Familia, designed by Antoni Gaudi. And I have seen this.
Is this it's in Barcelona?
Barcelona. I visited this church.
It's a church.
It's a church. It's gorgeous. It's massive. It's a Roman Catholic cathedral in Barcelona.
And will you just say, because I've not been to Barcelona, will you say, like, I know Gaudi is super famous, but is he the one that does, like, it's not rectilinear, it's like organic shapes?
It looks like it's dripping. Like, it looks, like, all of his stuff to me looks like it's melting.
Amazing.
It's so ornate, and yet it has this sort of, like, how do you build it? It has literally been under construction since 1882.
What?
He worked on it for 40 years before he died.
Oh my God.
Then when he died, his assistants took over the project, but then it was damaged during the Spanish Civil War. And since then, it's been in a state of flux. Like, no one can agree on how to finish it.
Of course.
And even though it's not finished, it's still the number one tourist attraction in the city. And
this
now,
is so good.
Now they're saying it will be finished in 2026. But we will see. Because I've read things that were like, when I was there, it's like, it's going to be done in 4 years. You know, it like,
can we just, can we all just agree, Barcelona, that it's going to be, it is going to be an evolving.
That's right. Perpetually
because
unfinished.
Because once it's completed, then repairs begin.
That's right. Like let's just be okay with it.
But how amazing. This spark is rocking my ass.
Yay.
Yeah. This is good.
So, if your work is left in the hands of someone who is a purist and wants the result to be as close to what you wanted, then you might have something like Janis Joplin. She died of a drug overdose during the recording sessions for Pearl.
Oh.
And they released the album with 10 songs.
That's a famous album.
The album is amazing. They had 10 songs done, and it also included 2 incomplete recordings. One they did as an instrumental that was buried alive in the blues. And the other, Mercedes-Benz, they released as an a cappella. I know that song. I never knew it was supposed to be anything other than a cappella. Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? You know that song?
Oh my God.
And you've heard it just the
that
way.
That was one of her most famous songs. And that was an unfinished.
Unfinished. Unfinished. And how great though that they didn't try to layer on their own ideas of
it. This is crazy.
This is crazy.
But maybe in that case, I guess you could look at a quilt that's in pieces, that there is embroidery that's not done, and say, clearly that's not finished. But a song, Mercedes-Benz, that feels like a complete expression.
It could, yeah.
So in I guess, but maybe that wasn't her original intention for it.
Right.
So fascinating.
It's so interesting, right?
Yeah.
In the theater, some people have assembled unfinished work into its own new project. Like recently, Jennifer Ashley Tepper presented the Jonathan Larson project.
Yes.
Feinstein's.
Hi, Jennifer Ashley Tepper.
Hi, Jen. But she went through his vast collection of unfinished ideas and sort of random lyrics and song demos, and she created a concert of 18 songs, and now that concert is available on Ghostlight Records. Amazing. As an album.
Amazing.
You know, and that work just probably wouldn't have gotten out otherwise.
Yeah.
So what I think is interesting is that, like, when it comes to art, obviously finished is an arbitrary concept. You know, you might be finished for now. You might want to go back to it later.
Yeah.
Some people are like, that piece of work is not unfinished. I'm done with it and I didn't want the world to see it.
Have you ever heard Stephen Sondheim says musicals aren't finished, they're just abandoned?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Sometimes you're like, I have given all I'm going to give.
That's right.
I'm moving on.
And in some of those cases, you might be happy that someone else picks up the torch, has a new fresh idea for it, and makes it into something else. But I think all of this got me considering, like, first of all, who are you leaving your unfinished work to?
Clearly in my will, it's you, Laura Camion.
And ditto, vice versa. And you're going to get a load of crap and figure out what to do with it.
A box of squilts.
Here's my bin of $5 squilts. But I think knowing who you're going to leave it to, expressing to them, you know, we do talk about death a good amount on this podcast.
Part of life.
But giving them explicit, you know, instructions or thoughts in any case, if anything is important to you, give them some notes. But then the other thing that struck me the most, because we never know how much time we have.
That's right.
If there is something that you have been itching to make,
yes,
and the thought of someone else making it for you drives you fucking crazy, then do it.
Do it.
Make it. Don't take That's any great. More time. Do it.
Yeah.
The poet Christina Rossetti said, "Can anything be sadder than work left unfinished? Yes, work never begun."
Camion, that spark is a great
day. There are some sparks in there.
That is sparks stacked on sparks, piled on top of other sparks, stuffed into a box of squilts that I'm going to buy at a garage sale for $1 million.
Oh,
that was beautiful.
Thanks for valuing it.
We were told to value our squilts. Can we change the name of this podcast to the Squilt File? The Squilt File.
The Squilt File.
That was beautiful.
Thanks.
Is there anything else to say?
That was it. That's all I wanted to say.
I am sparked by your sparks and by you, Laura Camion.
Thanks, Blackwell.
That is it. We hope that this put another bunch of squilts in your file. If there's a squilt, let Fetch go. It's not going to happen. If there's a spark that you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and fanned it into a creative flame, I'm never going to forget the word squilt. And you'd like to share it, email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com. We're going to have to also purchase the URL, the squilt file, as well before somebody else grabs it. Or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
I'm thinking some squilt merch. Okay?
I love
merch.
It.
So we'll even take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you've taken recently.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you like this podcast, share it with people that you love. And if you didn't like it, as Fleetwood Mac used to say, you can go your own way.
Go your own way. Oh, that's my line. Sorry, if something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark. and fan it into a squilt.
You got to paper mache it. You got to play it. You got to pack up your paints and your camera, move to Paris and Man Ray it.
What? You got to take it and make it.
Squilts.
Bye, squilts. Find your squilts.
Can I bump into something that inspires me? I dump it in my spark files. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark files. I jump into my spark files. Let's open up the spark file.